So I hope to entertain you otherwise. So to discover the inner workings of nature is, of course, a very old dream of mankind. And there was one guy, Dr. Faustus, who actually made a contract with the devil to obtain some magical powers. And we don't have these magical powers, so we have to work hard. And also, I still have to do with words and a few pictures. So to give you an overview of the talk, I represent a view of quantum gravity of different models, which can be all viewed as kind of state sum models. So I will summarize shortly these models and discuss in particular one a bit. And if you see it this way, then you can basically argue that you always have to introduce a regulator as a basically discretization. And the question arises whether your model depends on the regulator. And whether this is then connected to diffeomorphic symmetry and constraints in the canonical framework. After that, I will discuss the possibility to maybe obtain regulator independence by renormalization flow, which more or less is supposed to remove you, to give you the physics of continuum physics, and in this way remove you the regulator. And we will see that in this way we can basically connect different problems in the field and have a conjecture whether a solution of one problem might solve also the other problems. If there's time, I will discuss observables and background independent theories and what these might tell you about the structure of your theory, and then close with some conclusions. Okay, so many quantum gravity approaches can be seen as some kind of state sum models, and typically even many of them involve some microscopic sum over geometries. So basically this is supposed to be geometry, and you have to give me some description of how to construct the amplitudes, and then you try to sum over these. Of course, this is a very undefined procedure, so to make sense of that, we have to define how to do the sum, and you have to specify a measure, and depending on your model, it can be a discrete Cauchy measure, or if you have continuous labels, a continuous measure, and so on. And you can see that as part of your measure, or specify that separately, basically you have to specify what you want to sum over. And there are different possibilities. You can sum over triangulation, labels, meta labels, degenerate geometries, two complexes, graphs, topologies. And this basically you need to specify to define a model. And last but not least, you need to basically to define your amplitudes or the construction principle for your amplitudes. So you have some kind of choices. And different people probably prefer different choices, motivated by several things. One is basically, if you start with a continuum path integral, the way you choose to regularize this path integral. Another would be to try, which I will explain later, to construct your path integral or to construct your state sum model from a kind of canonical quantization. Then there's basically here is a possibility to sum over more or to sum over less. And there's some kind of tension. And naturally, I mean, as a lazy person, you would start to sum over less. and practicability. One other thing is that you might try to count your configurations and see whether you have exponentially many or whether there's any chance to get some well-defined sum, of course. But another to make you basically consider the question to sum over more is the principle to make a maximum number of features dynamically. So this will, of course, make your theory more powerful if you can, for instance, predict the topology of your universe by saying this is what emerges out of a sum over topologies. And the last but not least and very important one is, of course, experience. You can try a state sum model, which might not work out. Then you might try to figure out what was not working and modify your state sum model. So I think the big aims at the moment in the field are firstly to obtain 4D manifolds at large scales that also that have to satisfy the Einstein equations in the classical limit, plus, of course, corrections. And you hope that these corrections will solve your favorite problem, for instance, the solution of singularities and so on. So I didn't really give you these possibilities because I will mainly speak about the two first points. So the exciting thing is what we want to try is to have 4D spacetimes and more emerging as fully dynamical objects and not to have some kind of fixed backgrounds. So some models are the following ones. So there are spin form models, which I see very broadly, even, you know, including possibilities to derive spin form models from LQG. So these typically include some over labels, and these labels are spins on the faces and intertwiner on the edges. And then it depends on your definition whether you want to sum over two complexes. So two complexes are some generalization of dual triangulations or not. And there's a nice result which basically shows that we have some model, the FK, and the EPRL model, which gives you in the large spin limit the discretized Einstein-Hilbert action. So at least that is one step to show that you get actually the dynamics of general relativity. Another popular model at the moment are so-called causal dynamical triangulations, and they started out historically as dynamical triangulations. And these are quite cool in the sense that you just sum over triangulations. You don't have really labels on them. So typically, since you cannot do too much analytically in four dimensions, you have Monte Carlo simulations there and obtain phase diagrams, and you really see them as statistical models. Even more generally, you might start with a model which does not obviously have anything to do with geometries. So you have either a complete graph and sum over some discrete labels on this graph, which might give you sum over all graphs by turning on edges or not, or even some have some regular graph and sum over labels on this regular graph. And this might have the advantage that basically you can describe initial phases of the universe or some pre-geometries, and that motivates to consider basically such models. So let us look at dynamic triangulations, because here basically this factor of experience played a role to introduce causal dynamical triangulations. So typically what you started with is the sum over all kinds of triangulations, and this was done in the, for Euclidean gravity. So you had no restrictions whatsoever concerning causality. And if you looked at the configurations which you summed over, these included these kind of triangulations or geometries where it's not very obvious how to slice it such that you don't have a violation of causality.
Did they actually have the loop like handles like that, or was it only the space quality changed? I thought it was.
I think there was the handles. I mean, if you do a Euclidean even in 2D, you basically get the matrix models which allows in principle all kinds of handles. And then you go to the planar limit. Okay, and so this could be explored with Monte Carlo simulations, and mainly the following two phases were found, namely a phase where the effective dimension is infinity. Why is that infinity? Basically, it's a triangulation where almost every vertex is connected to every other vertex. If you consider the volume of a ball with distance r, you basically get a volume which is r to the infinity. So this is the definition of Hausdorff dimension, and you can see that as some kind of effective dimension. And the other phase was this branched polymer phase, where we have an effective dimension of equal to 2. So of course that doesn't really look like our universe. And this approach was more or less.
So in this cartoon, the lines stand for surfaces.
So these lines are really, if you look at microscopically, these are very small cubes build out of, even in four dimensional simply says. So you have two dimensions because you have the branching. Okay. Can you see that? You cannot see that? Okay. So the idea for causal dynamical triangulations was to restrict the sum such that you don't allow these configurations. So you only allow actually configurations which have a well-defined slicing in a sense. And you did that, what you cannot see is you did that by imposing some kind of sandwich structure on your triangulations. You have a very global restrictions on these triangulations. And you can argue that indeed these triangulations never allow for any violation of your causality. So you can, in principle, define light cones and so on everywhere. And the amazing result was, after a couple of years, that indeed in four dimensions, so for the four-dimensional model, you get an effective dimension of four. Okay. Oh. I think that is a very encouraging result because it's a proof of principle that non-perturbative gravity in this kind of state sum model language can be made to work. At least we get four-dimensional manifolds. Another lesson is that the choice of measure, basically the choice of what to sum over or not to sum over, can make a huge difference for your large-scale thing. So here the restriction is motivated by microscopic implementation of causality. Of course, you can now think about whether this should be a fundamental principle or not. And the other nice thing is that we easily see that space-time dimension is a dynamical concept. So starting with four-dimensional building blocks does not guarantee you four-dimensional macroscopic dimensions. And even more excitingly, the space-time dimension can change with the scale of your observation. So this is a plot of the spectral dimension. What is the spectral dimension? It basically probes the physics at different scales. You consider actually a random walk, and this random walk depends the properties of the random walk. Actually, the return property of the random walk depends on the number of time steps or the number of steps in your walk and the dimension. So you can basically look at the return probability on your space-time, on your typical configuration, and calculate back the effective dimension using these properties of the random walk. And if you do that basically with many time steps, so probing large-scale physics, you see these four dimensions. If you just go to shorter scales, so here you just look at 500 time steps, you basically find that it decreases to some value which is near 2. Sorry?
You mean independent of geometry?
Background dependent. Yeah, I will come to that.
Do you assume a topology and doing this?
And doing this, you have a fixed
topology.
You have a fixed topology.
And is there any effect of different topologies if you choose a different fixed topology?
There's in two dimensions, you can relax the causality restrictions. And you see that this model slowly turns into the full dynamical triangulation model, and in two dimensions we get the same result, that you have two faces with d equal to 2 and d equal to infinity. So summing over topologies makes a huge difference. And there are different models which basically try to interpolate between a fixed topology and a causality violation and summing over all topologies.
Is that work all done with Euclidean time still?
All work is done in Monte Carlo simulations, which assumes Euclidean amplitudes. But the other argument is that this slicing structure allows you a well-defined notion of the Wick rotation. But you have to think how to interpret basically your results in going from the Euclidean to the Lorentzian. Okay, so this is extremely nice because it hints at a built-in ultraviolet cutoff by dimensional reduction. And also it opens up new connections to other fields, namely a similar result was found in the asymptotic safety scenario by Lauscher and Reuter for the spectral dimension, which assumes that there's a non-Gaussian fixed point, doesn't assume it, but proves that there's a non-Gaussian fixed point for the normalization flow. And recently, also to the so-called Hurava-Lifshitz models, introduced by Hurava, which explicitly breaks Lorentz invariance, and where you basically have an anisotropic scaling between time and spatial dimensions. And he also claims that these models would have basically dimension, spectral dimension 2 at this, in the ultraviolet.
Sorry, the biggest part, how is the x-axis related to the Grady scale?
So this is basically the number of steps you consider in your random walk. And the argument is that if you consider more steps, you you poke large scale physics, because the particle is allowed to explore larger regions. Whereas if you have very few steps, you basically poke rather the microscopic structure of your spacetime. I mean, you can only go hop a few triangles, basically. And you see, I mean, it's 3,000, it can basically, in principle, go a large distance. It's 3,000 triangles or edges. Of course, there's still a couple of questions and remarks what one can think about in this model. And probably the most discussed one, does it reproduce the dynamics of general relativity? And I mean, they are actively working on that, so it would be interesting to see the results. There are some issues where one can try to pre-guess something, but which I think are not so far very conclusive. One is that the 2D, 3D, and 4D results all look very similar, and the dynamics of general relativity is not very similar in these different dimensions. So basically, that was, they worked through all the dimensions, and there was a nice paper by Dario and Joe, so showing that even you have a spectral, the same dimension, the same spectral dimension in the UV of 2. The other thing is that, at least in the arguments, they usually even say explicitly that these models are more driven by entropy considerations. So the number of configurations you sum over seems to be more important than the amplitude. But you might argue that the amplitude encodes general relativity. Of course, you can also be very happy if you believe in entropic gravity or something. So, no, I mean it seriously. another one is, of course, if you have anisotropic scaling, you would have Lorentz violation in the question if you see that on macroscopic scales. And apparently the last opinion is that they hope that they have both possibility in their phase diagram, so one fixed point with anisotropic and one with isotropic scaling. But in reading the paper, I think that was more like a hope. would be interesting to basically generalize this sandwich structure. I mean, it is actually generalized, the sandwich structure, to higher dimensions. So it can have actually different models where we have two special dimensions and two other dimensions and so on. And the question is, does the universality class change or not? If you have also anisotropic scaling in these models, so for the other dimension, you would, it's very likely that you have also anisotropic scaling for the one dimension. So this is basically more trying to see whether how many universality classes you have. Okay. Related is, does diffeomorphism symmetry emerge? And I will try to actually define what do I mean with diffeomorphism symmetry for this model. Finally, if you want to make the connection with some kind of renormalization, and in this, I think in this language, you should apply some kind of Wilsonian renormalization flow. You would expect that it introduces labels back again. So you could try to start with a larger class of models from the beginning. Okay. And an interesting question is there any alternative mechanism that basically results in this causality restriction.
I mean, the law group would probably say that with regard to diffeomorphism there, everything's already diffeomorphism inverse, right?
Yeah, indeed the law group says that. That's a,
so you don't have to look
at diffeomorphism symmetry. Mm-hmm. Okay, but it's more a question about the dynamics of general relativity. If you, whether you have two propagating modes or.
Therefore, why can they say that?
Okay. You see, there are different opinions in the field, which is the subject of my talk. Okay. So of course, in these discrete models, you have the difficulty of speaking what is a diffeomorphism. And I find it not a very good point because in the continuum, diffeomorphisms are deeply entangled into the dynamics of general relativity. So there are several arguments busy saying if you impose diffeomorphism symmetry, fix your number of degrees of freedom, then you uniquely get general relativity as your theory. Whereas our experience so far has shown if you don't have diffeomorphism symmetry and try to break it, you usually end up with huge problems. So the question is, how can we implement diffeomorphism symmetry in discrete models? And for instance, discuss whether causal dynamical triangulations are diffeomorphism invariant or not. And there's really two other questions. Is there any relation of diffeomorphism symmetry to renormalization? Usually it's quite difficult actually to have a renormalization into which preserves symmetries. And a relation of diffeomorphism symmetry to background independence. So I think for the next few slides, I really start from the following assumption that I consider state-sum models based on triangulations or other discrete structures, and I will see them as explicit regulator. And you can really ask what happens with this regulator or the underlying triangulation. Does it spoil background independence in the sense that if your result depends on your triangulation, you can argue that you put your triangulation in as a background? Yes?
Just to be precise, so now you're fixing a triangulation and you're summing over labels?
Yes, I will busy, yeah.
Okay.
So to not spoil background independence, there are different proposals in the field, which is one is that you say it defines your fundamental theory. The other is takes a refinement limit, and the third is to sum over triangulations. So this, I mean, defines a fundamental theory. It's a, for instance, loop quantum gravity or continuous. I mean, the standard loop quantum gravity philosophy is that it is a fundamental theory, and indeed. It is if you can show that your partition function is already invariant under the triangulation. And then the question is how to find such models. I mean, these kind of models were sought for a long time. The other possibility takes a refinement limit and hopes that you will get something regulator independent. Basically, one argument for that is that the sum over labels automatically incorporates the sum over the causal triangulations. So that you might hope that you get the regulator independence in the limit. And the sum over triangulations gives you naturally something which is invariant of a particular triangulation. And there's a framework to do this sum. Of course, you can basically ask the question, what are the measures? What do you sum over again? And the framework are group field theories. And thanks to Raswan, we even have now group field theories, which in principle define new sums over with different measures, which sum over different kinds of triangulations. Of course, causal dynamical triangulations does the sum over a specific kind of triangulation. Okay, and I won't, I mean, you can basically ask yourself, where you put yourself in. But I find it very difficult to define where, for instance, loop quantum gravity is. If you see it as this, in the standard philosophy of a continuum theory, you would put it there. If you derive a path integral from that, you would think that at some point in the path integral, you put a regulator, and then you would take the refinement limit. On the other hand, if your Hamiltonian operator is graph changing, you might effectively sum over triangulations. Okay. And in the end, there might be the hope that like these different proposals might not be too different or might be maybe summarized in some kind of meta language. if you hope that basically the sum over labels includes the sum over causal triangulations, then there might be a hope that at least for a fixed topology, you have some kind of effective measure which is induced from this side to this side and the other way around. And here you might hope that via renormalization flow, if you really can take the refinement limit and then coarse grain, you might find the models which are really triangulation independent. Okay. So the question is, how do we find such regulator independent models? And is there a relation to diffeomorphic symmetry? And as I mentioned, or as was pointed out in the discussion, the issue of diffeomorphic symmetry is quite involved in discrete models. Even Ratchey wrote his, I mean, introducing Ratchey calculus. The title was General Relativity Without Coordinates, so he was hoping that he got rid of the diffeomorphism equivalence class. Also, causal dynamical triangulations, or Carlo, usually argues that, for instance, spin foams are already geometries. Okay. Some confusing point is that if you derive your path integral from canonical framework, it suggests that symmetries are related to constraints. So what I found always confusing is that you want to make the connection to loop quantum gravity, have constraints there, which suggests that you should have some symmetries in your path integral. And so let me summarize shortly path integral from canonical quantization. So here's canonical quantization in 5 seconds. Naturally, you have some kind of Hilbert space and some kind of states. And the central object in general relativity, canonical general relativity, are the constraint operators. They encode the dynamics and generate basically also the diffeomorphic symmetries. And what you have to do with these constraint operators is to find states which are annihilated by these constraint operators, because this would give you gauge invariant states. So this can be seen as a kind of Schrödinger equation for your system. And typically what you will find is that all these states are not normalizable in your usual product. So the other thing which you have to do is to find an inner product on the space of solutions to the constraints. And part of my PhD was to test a specific suggestion to do that. But one proposal to obtain such states is basically also you sum over all gauge orbits, which is known as group averaging or refined algebraic quantization. So that is just group averaging. So you take your state, you generate gauge orbits on your state, and you integrate this state over all gauge orbits, and you hope that, I mean, usually, depending on the measure which you put, which is actually very difficult, you hope to find gauge invariant states. And from this, making kind of formal manipulations, you actually get a kind of path integral description for the inner product between two states. So path integral description where you put two states on the boundary of your spacetime. Okay. And says in this sense, constraints imply symmetries in your path integral. On the other hand, I mean, you sum over gauge orbits and you want to have an amplitude which is basically invariant or constant on these gauge orbits. Otherwise, you don't find a gauge invariant result. On the other hand, there's a paper by Halliwell and Hartle, which show nicely that if you construct a wave function out of a path integral with symmetries, you will find constraints. So if you do that, you can, of course, ask for these discrete models, what are these gauge symmetries? And we will go back to our discrete triangulations and apply a specific definition of when do you have a symmetry or when is a symmetry broken. And this definition just is the usual definition of gauge symmetries, namely that you have non-uniqueness of solutions given some fixed boundary data. That motivates on introducing actually gauge equivalence classes because you want that these solutions don't represent different physical states. So if you have non-uniqueness of solutions and if you count basically the number of variables and the number of equations you have, it implies if you have non-uniqueness that the equations of motion are not independent. So some of your variables remain free, which are exactly the gauge variables. Okay, if you apply that to discrete models, then firstly we need a canonical formalism with the discrete time and allowing for local evolution and reproducing exactly the covariant dynamics. And typically for triangulation, there's a problem of defining general hypersurfaces in your 4D triangulation. But there's a nice idea of Raphael, which are so-called tent moves, which you can apply to general three-dimensional triangulation. And in this way, generate four-dimensional manifolds. So we took this idea of tent move, and more or less we took this framework of consistent discretization. And we defined basically canonical framework for redshift calculus, in this sense, for dynamics based on triangulation, which exactly reproduces you the covariant dynamics. And one can show for these systems with discrete time evolution that if the symmetry is exact, which as I argued implies that the equation of motion are not independent, you will find constraints because the constraints are exactly some representation of this equation of motion. And they're also first class. If the symmetries are broken, then this equation of motion are not independent, and you find pseudo-constraints. What do you mean with pseudo-constraints? Constraints give you conditions for one time. Pseudo-constraints, basically, the constraints are just equation of motion which only involve variables of one time step. And these pseudo-constraints have a very weak coupling to the next time step, basically. Now the analysis of different examples in 1D, 3D gravity with and without a cosmological constant, and 4D linearized gravity basically showed in all these examples that in the covariant level, a symmetry under vertex translation results in Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints. And if you have a model which has these symmetry as exact symmetries, you also find a closed constraint algebra for these discrete geometries. Yes? Yes. On the next slide. So what do you mean with a vertex translation? So if you consider 3D, and you have a fixed boundary or fixed data on your boundary. In this case, it's the boundary of a tetrahedra. And you have these three, four dynamical edge lengths. And you solve the equation of motion. You find that, okay, you can easily find solutions by just putting a vertex in your flat tetrahedra. And you find that you can move this vertex around. So there's a three-parameter set of solutions. And so I will define these vertex translations, not necessarily in flat space, if there's this parameter set of solutions which basically allows you to translate this vertex around, and this will change the induced length of these edges naturally.
And the edge length variable is a continuous variable?
In my classical, it's in Ricci calculus in this case. It's classical Ricci calculus. I mean, we know that we have also these in the Ponzano-Ricci model, these symmetries in the 3D. Yeah. okay. So do we have a discretization of 4D actions where these vertex translation symmetries are realized also for curved solutions? Because I gave you examples which were basically all either linearized on flat space or flat. So there's a paper by Hammer and Williams which actually did some calculation in two dimensions and three dimensions and somehow claimed that therefore it should also hold for four dimensions. But we considered an explicit example, and there it was not the case. So the symmetries are really broken. And this, the problem of having a consistent constraint algebra for discrete geometries is related to this question. And this is basically the main problem for canonical lattice models and the numerical relativity. And I think it's the reason why nobody is really doing the canonical lattice models, because you never manage to define a consistent constraint algebra. And in this case, we have a consistent constraint exactly in the cases where we have actually actions with symmetries. So for sectors which basically describe flat or homogeneously curved dynamics. So we now have also a first formulation of consistent constraints in linearized discrete gravity, so that it works to this linear order for arbitrary spatial triangulations. And the other thing is, at least for Ricci calculus, these constraints are really based on vertices, and move these vertices around as a canonical implication of basically having constraints which deform your hypersurface by pulling at the vertex and you're embedding four-dimensional manifold. Okay. A remark on loop quantum gravity. We have an anomaly free constraint algebra in the sense that it's abelian. But the reason for that is that the underlying graph has changed. So it does not really correspond to a fixed triangulation without interaction between the dual vertices. And so far, I think that the dynamical interpretation of these Hamiltonian constraints is a bit difficult. That's at least not clear to me. So what we can argue is that obtaining anomaly free constraints is actually equivalent to constructing an action with exact symmetries. So if we criticize the canonical guys, you first have to give me this action. And the question now is, how can we construct actions with these exact symmetries?
Mm-hmm. Does it correspond to appearance of new degrees of freedom? Or?
Yeah, I will argue tomorrow or in these simple examples. it's degrees of freedom and additional degrees of freedom, because you find, for instance, that in 3D with a cosmological model, with a simple Ricci action, you have many degrees of freedom. But what you hope for, or what at the moment many people hope for, without telling you, that these degrees of freedom have very short correlation lengths. And you can see in the one-dimensional models, indeed, these are degrees of freedom which don't appear in the kinematical term, but appear in the potential term. So they are dynamically very different in that. Typically, if you do this, speak of perturbations, you don't have a propagator. But I will also argue tomorrow that it gives you actually great difficulties if you try to do graviton scattering on a fixed triangulation. Because, you have these gauge modes appearing just to higher order, but you don't have them as in a propagator. You don't have a propagator for these modes. Okay. broken symmetries in lattice models, it's an old problem. For instance, in quantum chromodynamics, where the breaking of Lorentz symmetry on a lattice leads to the fermion double problem, the doubling problem. And there's an old suggestion to use so-called improved and perfect actions at QCD, which is actually quite hard, I have to tell you, to do it for QCD, but you can do it in simple examples. And the idea is that basically you just do a renormalization group transformation. So you take your given triangulation or your given discretization, you fine-grain this triangulation, and you integrate out fine-grained degrees of freedom. So very classically, we just need to solve the equation of motion for these fine-grained degrees of freedom. That defines you an effective action by putting back the solutions to a new action on the coarse-grained lattice, but it captures the dynamics of your fine-grained lattice. So if you take the infinite refinement limit, you will capture the continuum physics on on your lattice, on your coarse-grained lattice. And it works for Lorentz symmetry, but the question is, does it also work for local gauge symmetries from the continuum? So this is a question, and we basically are slowly trying to work through examples. And the answer is yes, in 1D and in 3D with a cosmological constant. Yeah, in 3D with a cosmological constant, the usual redshade triangulation does not give you the symmetries. Interesting question if that can be repeated in the quantum case. So what we started to look at is a non-topological series, which we will expect, or which we basically are already sure, will lead you to non-local actions, for instance, in this example, and also in this example. Okay. So I guess you know what redshift calculus is. So redshift calculus gives you a specific discretization of your action. It's a very nice discretization because then the action just looks quite simple. So you have basically a curvature term. There's a curvature is encoded in these deficit angles. And you have, if you have a cosmological constant, you have the volume term times the cosmological constant. And in this discretization, usually you discretize by using basically piecewise flat manifolds. And if we do that with 3D redshift calculus and with a cosmological constant, you find unique solutions to the equation of motion, implying that all the degrees of freedom are actually physical. Without a cosmological constant, you basically have this vertex translation, and for a trivial topology, you will find zero physical degrees of freedom. So here, you have exactive homomorphism symmetry, and here you have approximative homomorphism symmetry. And if you believe that this gives you still a good approximation to continuum physics, you have somehow the problem that in the continuum limit, you introduce more and more physical degrees of freedom, but you hope that they will all drop out at some point. So what we have shown is that if you start with this action, which basically assumes piecewise linear building blocks and getting to this triangulation, it gives you a triangulation-dependent action with approximate symmetries. Now, if you do this renormalization flow and do this fine graining from the continuum, you find another action where basically now you have defined new building blocks dynamically, and these building blocks turn out to be homogeneously curved simplices, tetrahedra. The interesting point here is that this action, if you want to write it explicitly as a function of the length, it's a very hard mathematical problem. So it's not solved to write it explicitly as a function of the edges. And this gives you the action for simplices with curvature. Also, it has exact symmetries. So we have, again, the exact vertex translations. And it's triangulation independent. You solve the equation of motion.
Yeah.
So it's h bar is equal to zero. fits. So this puts forward the conjecture that actions with exact diffeomorphism invariants might be actually automatically triangulation independent. And it's supported by this, okay, so far a class of topological examples or examples with finitely many degrees of freedom. But also if you consider the canonical framework, ultimately it should support both continuous evolution and discrete evolution. When discrete evolution is, imagine that you have a triangulation, you can basically evolve different vertices. So you get different triangulation by evolving different vertices in different order. But basically the essence of the constraint algebra is actually to ensure that your result does not depend on how you basically evolve, how you choose your Laplace and shift function. So this basically requires that you should have some kind of triangulation independence for the canonical framework. And there's some abstract consideration based on category theory saying that there's a theorem by Pachner that smooth for D manifolds and diffeos as a category are equivalent to piecewise linear manifolds and Pachner moves. Okay. So as a comment, if you would say that there might be some equivalence between diffeomorphism invariants and triangulation independence, then causal dynamical triangulations sum only over foliation preserving triangulations. So it's a special class of triangulation. This doesn't prove that it cannot be diffeomorphism invariant, but you might basically be a bit doubtful. So to summarize, so actions for 4D with exact diffeomorphism invariants might be constructed by renormalization group methods. And I don't hope that we can find them explicitly, but there might be basically some perturbative framework for that. These would also allow construction of anomaly-free canonical lattice models and might be triangulation independent. So this has to be proven. And in general, there's basically the question, is there a universality class of associated statistical models with diffeomorphism invariants? Or how uniquely are these models with diffeomorphism invariants? So this shows that these two proposals might be connected by some kind of effective action via coarse graining. And if it automatically gives you triangulation-independent models, then, of course, also the sum over triangulation should be connected to these proposals. Also, you see that basically these three different problems might be connected to each other, and solving one might at least give you some hints how to solve the other problem. So what are the implications for the quantum gravity partition here? I think we should really take diffeomorphism symmetry in discrete models seriously. And one is to understand the interplay of renormalization and diffeomorphism symmetry. Another is, of course, if you go to spin form models, and we know that there are some divergencies, you should try to understand at least the divergencies which are induced by your symmetry and which might not be physical, before trying to get rid of them. And in these invariant gravity, the constraints are corresponding to vertex translations are based on the vertices of the triangulation and not on the dual vertices. Okay. So one big aim would be actually to understand the measure on the space of geometries induced by different models, because basically I think that is one point where these models really differ from each other. And the question is, can we really emulate the sum over triangulation to sum over labels of a finer triangulation? Okay. So, tomorrow I will speak more about this perturbative expansion and explain the difficulties with this perturbative expansion. And I now slightly change subject, observables and background independent series. what do they imply? Okay. So Einstein was making the comment in the course of complaining about quantum theory that whether you can observe a thing or not depends on the theory which you use. So it's a theory which decides what can be observed. What I will argue is that you can try to turn this claim around and ask what can you observe principally in background independent theory and what does it imply for your theory? Okay. So I guess So we have done these considerations in the canonical framework, so I will shortly explain what does it mean to have an observable in the canonical framework. And so usually what and diffeomorphism immer and observables in general relativity characterize basically the solutions of the theory. And to parameterize the solutions and also do canonical quantization, you go to phase space. That is, phase space just gives us an initial data description, and basically you hope that initial data on your hypersurface give you some solution, and that there might be some one-to-one correspondence. However, if you have gate symmetries, then this correspondence is not one-to-one, but you have basically constrained hypersurfaces and gauge orbits in your phase space. And in general relativity, these gauge orbits are equivalent to basically considering the dynamics of the theory, because evolving this hypersurface to another hypersurface gives you the same solution to the equation of motion. So these two initial data are gauge equivalent. So diffeomorphisms immer and observables as function of the initial data have to be constants on the gauge orbits. And this basically implies that you have to solve part of the theory defined to find observables. In particular, if you are background independent, you can argue that you should only allow for relational observables, which use some variables to define a reference system, which I will call clocks, and make observations relative to this reference system. So to find such relational observables, you choose these clocks, you choose parameters tau, and you consider the condition that these clocks have to be equal to these parameters. So you pick out a specific hypersurface here, and then given your initial data, you have to calculate your observable on this hypersurface. So you ask the question specifically to this hypersurface given by these parameters. So there's a computational framework to compute these observables. Of course, you cannot make explicit calculations. So there's a perturbative framework. And this can be used to discuss structural properties of your observable algebra. And there's one property which is connected to the problem of time in general relativity. And one aspect of this problem of time is it's very hard to find perfect clocks with standard matter. What do you mean with perfect clocks? It's just clocks which always go forward and which never go backwards. And you can take two different approaches by this. You can do this. You can basically change this by adding some non-standard matter, ether, or Born-Kukac dust, or do the Tavis thing, the tensor vector scalars thing series. Or you can basically consider the question of given the fact that I don't have perfect clocks, what are the limitations on my observables are structural properties of my quantum gravity theory? Okay, so if you do these relational observables and consider basically as your clocks for scalar fields, take a fifth scalar field, ask the question, what is the value of my fifth scalar field at the point where four scalar fields give me certain parameters tau? You can compute the commutator, the Poisson brackets, between these two two observables at different parameters. So if you assume that we have good clocks, this gives you two different space-time points. And in the quantization, this will be equivalent to the two-point function. And what you find is that in this approximation that epsilon is small, you get the usual two-point function on flat space plus an additional term, which goes as energy of your field, which you observe, divided by the energy of your clocks. Indeed, you can argue that you can only make good observations if the energy of your clocks, that is, if the clocks go fast enough, for which you need a high energy of your clocks. Now, these guys have, I mean, a chain of arguments, which in the end gives you some super holographic locality bound. And the idea is here, okay, if you want to basically test a certain region of space-time with a given resolution, you have to put lots of clocks with a certain amount of energy, but you cannot put too much energy in one given region, so you have to prevent black hole formation. So this allows you only to consider a certain number of degrees of freedom in a given space-time region. And here, the space-time region is basically here, this super holographic bound even scales even less than the holographic bound. So where R usually goes with the surface, which means with R squared, it goes there with R to the power of 3/2. Also in quantum mechanical toy examples, you basically can consider, for instance, the time of arrival operator, which so far hasn't been really quantized. You find additional uncertainty relations, which go also with the inverse of the kinetic energy of your particle. So to summarize here, background independence requires relational observables. And if you don't put extra matter, these only allow for finite resolution of space-time. So you won't find this relation if you have matter which basically allows for Hamiltonian linear in the momenta. So somehow with putting in this matter, you basically assume that it would also allow for infinite good resolution. Or in other words, you easily see that this would give you clocks which always go forward. So is this a hint for quantum gravity theories? If you think of a lattice, ultimately your observables should be completely independent from the choice of lattice, of course, but this basically excludes observables which you put on your lattice sides. So basically the observables should completely free themselves from the lattice. Okay, come to the conclusion. I think we have encouraging results in different approaches. And hopefully, I mean, we have seen convergence of approaches, which I mean, as you might know, basically a convergence of canonical and covariant approaches. And here I argued that there's also might be convergence on defining the dynamics and connecting between the dynamics of canonical and covariant approaches, and asymptotic safety scenario, for instance, in non-perturbative models. And I think understanding the interplay of diffeomorphic symmetry and renormalization group theory should lead to an even better understanding of difference and similarities between these different approaches. And one aim or one nice thing to do would be to try to group basically all these background independent or these state sum models into different universality classes. Okay, thank you. Now I'm finished.
So I always find it very hard to imagine how there could be triangulation independence in 4D quantum gravity as opposed to in the sense that there is in, say, 3D spin quantum models. Because it seems, I mean, maybe my intuition is completely wrong here, but it just seems like in 4D where there are local degrees of freedom, say you want to have like a lot of degrees of freedom in an area that's very big, I mean, volume is very big compared to the Planck scale, then, you know, if you have a very, can't you do a reduction out of CERN by just making the triangulation very, very sparse, and then you say, well, there's not enough degrees of freedom now to do it. I mean, that argument doesn't apply in 3D, so it always seems to me like it's a sort of red herring to look at, to get this sort of inspiration from 3D. So I don't understand. Can you tell me why that intuition is wrong, if it is?
So I think one answer to that is that in 4D you would expect very non-local actions.
It contains
more information. It distributes this information very non-locally until it distributes all the information on the boundary, if you want. So if you don't define the boundary of your triangulation, you could argue that basically,
information's gone up to the boundary.
If you basically take the Hamilton-Jacobi, if you define the Hamilton-Jacobi functional of this from the continuum series, if that would be possible, then you would have something triangulation independent, in a sense. So this could be in one answer that basically what you should expect is very non-local actions. And indeed, I mean, if you, I should think that you also should basically refine your boundary. This would rather correspond to a true renormalization flow, that you also make observations on a larger scale and allow basically for fine graining also of the boundary.
Any other questions?
So you covered a lot of stuff and you discussed a lot of proposals that people have made over the years. And you implied that they're not correct or they failed because you have your own proposal. So I wonder if I can hone you down on two of them. So over here, the group field theory point of view is you have something which generalizes the matrix model, which defines a sum over some combinatorial structures.
Yes.
And you suggest sum and close your eyes and sum. So clearly, you don't like that, or you find that something wrong with that, or you wouldn't be doing all those other things. You wouldn't be worrying carefully about how to express diffeomorphism invariance without summing over triangulations.
I'm just a bit worried how to define the sum over triangulations. If I just think about triangulations, then there are many moves on many different triangulations, which give you the same geometry.
Are you worried that the group field theory sums partition functions are not well defined?
Yes, or this is my. I don't know how practical it is to get really, you know, information about that.
Okay, so that.
And the causal dynamical triangulation or dynamical triangulation rather. The experience from going to from dynamical triangulation to causal dynamical triangulation is that in this case it was good to sum over less.
Sure.
Of course, I mean, probably we don't like this restriction, so that, I mean, you might ask yourself, is there some other more diffeomorphism invariant restriction, which nevertheless gives you the same universality class.
But in the GFT picture, using that exactly right, because the GFT picture, and the proposal has been here for a long time, that, of course, by looking at renormalization of GFT, what you're looking at, from the space-time point of view, is a coarse grading picture there, and then you should focus on, understanding the connection between the two.
That is the connection, would be the question. Is there an effective measure which you get from summing over triangulation? I mean, ultimately, it might be that you can only get triangulation-independent models by summing over triangulation. But, I mean, it would be interesting to see, is there an effective measure on the labels and considering some fixed triangulation?
Good. So let me just ask you on the other side. So the old sort of Reisenberger proposal that the inner product of the physical over space is defined by the partition function. You also passed that by. Did you have an objection to that? And then you never came back to the issue of what defines the physical in product.
I didn't say that it was wrong, no.
So I'm curious about what you...
This argument was to show that you can get some kind of fast integral from your canonical quantization. Of course, then the question, this was quite a formal argument. The question is, still you have to regulate your path integral, and that depends on which dynamics you put, whether it gives you some over triangulation or not.
Well, I think at the time their argument, which maybe one criticizes being naive, was that the regulator is built in by the discreteness of area and volume, and therefore there may be need for an infrared regulator, but which perhaps the cosmological constant would supply. But there's no need for an ultraviolet regulator. So that's certainly what was said at the time. Do you disagree with that?
I mean, I still hope that there is some self-regulating thing, but you should, if you take a fixed triangulation and only sum over the labels, and you find that the diffeomorphism is broken, then I think you might have a problem in having basically a Lorentz violating theory. If you say you should sum over triangulations, you basically include some finer, fine-grained triangulations. Of course, quantum mechanically, you can say there's a minimal volume, but still, you can have finer triangulations. Mm-hmm. And still, you would sum over all triangulations. And this would define, I mean, you could still define a fixed point in renormalization theory.
If you could.
If there's a fixed point, or if it's independent in how you refine, but I just think it might be a bit naive to not do sum over triangulations, or and the question is it more practical to sum over triangulations, or to look what could basically a triangulation independent model look like by doing renormalization, which is just some maybe more regular or more regulated method to sum over triangulation.
So that's your strategy.
Yeah.
If you like it in that shot.
And just keep different options open and try to explore whether these methods are equivalent. And in a sense, I think they should just be differ by your choice of measure on how you weight your triangulations, which I think is not really predicted by the theory. And you might make a choice which rather easily gives you triangulation independence, the question is the relation between choosing a measure and diffeomorphism invariance. That diffeomorphism invariance can, of course, make big restrictions to your choice of models, to your choice of measure, and I think we just should actively look for, ask these questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Coordinate variance, we're just, that's, we think of that as reflecting the fact that different coordinates are just different ways of describing the same mathematical object as Riemannian manifold. If the theory did turn out to be triangulation, is there some analogous interpretation of what is the mathematical object all the triangulations are described? Are all different ways of.
So you ask if you have a triangulation independent theory,
what is the analog
of that in the continuum? There was this category theoretical argument that that the category of piecewise linear manifolds modeled out by Pachner moves which generate two different triangulation. Pachner moves on a fixed topology are ergodic, so you basically generate all kinds of different triangulation on a fixed topology. So this category is equivalent, so there's a functor, to the space of to the category of smooth manifolds modeled out by diffeomorphisms. Now, it's a nice argument, but I think it's still a kinematical argument. I mean, I would like really to think more on dynamics, and I think this approach at least makes all these actions or this definition of diffeomorphism symmetry ties it more to the dynamics of the theory and renormalization flow. So to answer the other question, basically, if you have a triangulation-independent model, it basically means you are on a fixed point of your theory, of your model, a renormalization fixed point. If you be fine, you will find the same physics.
But that's, I mean, I think there's like, what you say, it seems like there's two points concerning the last. So it's true, if you're doing machine independent, you're at the refinement. But the reverse is not true. You can have a theory which is invariant under refinement. So let's say for the invariant under the 1-4 move, but not invariant under the 3-3. So, triangulation dependence is way, 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 way more restrictive than just refinement independence. Because refinement, and I think this is the key difference. Now, concerning the first, you see, this is a very key difference. You can have a theory which is refinement independent, and this has nothing to do with triangulation independence. It's a fact no moving 3D, as you know very well. You know, there are different types of fact.
Yeah,
refinement,
but if
independence. You know, imply that they're going to be, you know, invariant under 1-4, eventually, you know, but not under the 3-3. That's the key difference. So, along the 3 move, you can choose. 1 is not implied along by refinement independence and by, you know, randomization arguments.
Yeah, but if you say that, I mean, that you have a perfect action,
yeah,
which represents your continuum theory, then basically your physical results should not depend how you triangulate the bulk. And basically it should give you the same answer, because it should give you the continuum
answer. If you have a way to go from the two configurations by refinement, yes.
Independent from your choice of triangulation.
No, I think it seems to me you're missing two things here. If you have two actions, same boundary, you can get from one to the other by a different refinement, yes, that's okay.
But even in the bulk, I speak of the bulk. I mean, you fix the boundary, you can have a 3-3 move in
the
bulk.
Then you don't have even a 3-3, you know, then you don't even have a model which depends on the triangulation. Like, you mentioned Hamilton Jacobi function, I give you like piecewise boundary like that. I just get my number. But I don't get this number by chopping off my number for this in the spaces. That's kind of a different thing. If you want to have some kind of type of local action for certain type of building block and gluing them, I think in 4D you have to be very careful that there's, you know, back to moving parts, there's a long list of things to check.
But there
you can look at one move in 4D, which is very different from 3D, that is not on these checklists.
Okay, I mean, we have two things. I mean, one thing is that, okay, if you do the sum over triangulation, then the result should be also invariant on a 3-3 partner move.
Then it means you're going to include the sum of a 3-3 move, which is very easy to do because it's a finite sum, given the boundary data.
It's not a finite sum.
For everybody else, I think this, my hearing of this discussion is this is a simple issue, which is, to correct me if I'm wrong, what you mean by a perfect action corresponds in a Wilsonian sense to a whole renormalization group trajectory.
Yeah.
Which has a principle for any refinement in infinite number of terms. Okay. And is this a confusion between that, which is what I think you mean by a triangulation independent theory, a triangulation independent discrete theory would correspond to a whole Wilsonian renormalization group trajectory. And there's a different thing, some of those trajectories, but not all of them, are fixed points in the renormalization group and just sit there. And those correspond to scale invariant theories, but it's not necessary that a triangulation independent theory be a scale invariant theory.
No.
Right. So I think that's the confusion.
Maybe. I'm just saying there's just the difference between, you know, being invariant under refinement, which is what you're saying, and being invariant under triangulation. It's not the same class. And that's. So the physical argument is that you should be invariant to be, you know, refinement. But that doesn't mean that, you know.
So I can imagine that you try to be invariant on a 3-3 move by summing over all kinds of 3-3 moves.
Yeah, good. And
so
and
then you are invariant on a 3-3 moves. And what's
okay, but then that's an issue. So it goes back to this other thing that you said about, you know, equivalence, you know, the fact that I think it's another kind of confusion. The fact that the class of diffeo invariant manifold is equivalent to the class of piecewise linear modular packing mode, which is fine, because it's true. But here, it refers only to topological class. So pure manifold knows the structure than being differentiable or piecewise linear. Whereas what you're interested in gravity, and it goes back to the question of Joe, is in fact you're interested in metrical manifolds. So this manifold adds on top of that some extra structure. And if you look at, let's say, in 3D, the space of three spheres which are Einsteinian, there's only one, right? So in 3D, it happens that the class of Einsteinian manifold and the class of topological manifold are the same. But in 4D, that's not the case. If you give me a 4D topological manifold like the full sphere, there are many, many Einsteinian dimensions you can put on it. And that's why, you know, therefore, you expect that there is a way in which, you know, locally or, you know, in some way, there will be extra labels that account for the fact that even for a given topological manifold, you should be able to pinpoint down different, you know, metric elements. So this original argument by Pfeiffer, you know, it's just also mixing something. The fact that you forget about the metrical information, mixing topology and class.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't proven that by refinement you get invariants under Sri-Sri moves, of course. But I think you could get it by, again, summing over triangulations.
Yeah, you have to sum. I'm fine if you sum over Sri-Sri moves. This is a finite sum for fixed
manifolds. So then, okay, then you sum, and then you get something which is invariant under Sri-Sri moves and nevertheless should give you gravity.
But the
there might be, I think there might be still the possibility that you might get it by doing some fine graining, because even if you choose 1-5 move for two in different order, you might reproduce a 3-3 move. I don't know why I have shown that. So, I mean, it's just that one should really look at these examples.
I think you can stop here. Thank you.